Ready to proceed? Well, join the crowd. Justice Holland has laryngitis, and we're asking questions for him.
Okay.
If you want someone to make the argument for you, Mr. Bernstein, he's there.
Well,
at the table.
I'm looking around, but I don't see anybody wants to do it. So, may I please the court, Chief Justice Steele, members of the court. My name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm here on behalf of Akbar Hassan L. In connection with his appeal from his conviction for felony murder, weapons, and related charges. I want to focus my remarks this morning on the issues concerning the panel's ruling about the admissibility of the Zayas videotape. And as the court is aware, and I know at least three of you are aware anyway, the panel ruling, what the jury heard, was not just what Mr. Zayas was telling the police, but the jury also heard the police commentary on whether or not Mr. Zayas at any given point in time was being truthful with them. They would say things like, we know what happened, we know who did it, we know you're not telling the truth, when they thought he was not being truthful with them. When they thought he was being truthful with them, statements were made to the effect of, now you're on the right track. They give him literally a pat on the back. And that's what it wasn't just listening to a tape recording. This was a videotape. So the jury got the, heard and saw, not just what Zayas said, what the police were saying. And I think correct, and this video was objected to at trial. The argument was it just went way beyond 3507, and the panel agreed. And we agree with that conclusion, obviously. However, that ruling did not get Mr. Hassan L. a new trial, because the panel decided or concluded that any error in admitting this video was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the panel cited two reasons. First reason was there was a limiting instruction given. And the second reason was, and I'm going to quote here, the strength of the state's case, unquote. Now, as the court is aware, a motion for rehearing in bank was filed and was granted, and that's why we're here today. Now, I would suggest that a threshold issue, at least with respect to the Zayas video issue, is whether or not the court can even consider the harmless error issue. And I say that principally for the reason that if you review the state's answering brief in this case, and if you look for the words harmless error in any of the arguments, you're not going to find it. The state simply did not raise a harmless error argument, even though this court's precedent is that the burden is on the appellant to show error. And once that happens, the burden shifts to the state to show the error was harmless. And the state has both the burden of proof on the harmless error issue and the burden of going forward. And our position is that the state did neither in this case. This court's Rule 14 says in so many words, if you don't make an argument in your brief, we can't consider it. And I don't know if there's an escape clause in there. Now, in our motion for a hearing, we cited some federal cases where they interpret their own rules, at least at the appellate level, to allow, in very limited circumstances, appellate courts sua sponte to raise a harmless error issue where it wasn't raised by the parties. And if you look at those cases, one conclusion you draw is it's very, very rarely invoked. And the principal reason is that the court says, we're not going to make your case, state. We're not going to look through this record when you're not pointing us anywhere to try and figure out whether this is harmless error or not.
Is the rule in Giovannetti the appropriate rule?
Well, that seems to be the only rule I could find. Most of the cases rely on Giovannetti. At least they cite that. That's the most cited case.
Are you arguing for any different rule?
Well, My position is, or our position is, that if you look, and Giovannetti finds authority to consider harmless error sua sponte in very limited circumstances based on the federal rules of appellate procedure. And if you look at the Delaware rule, Rule 14, the Delaware rule seems to be much, much stricter than the federal rule. It certainly has never been interpreted, at least as far as I'm aware, to allow the court to consider sua sponte an argument that nobody has raised. So that's something I think this court obviously is going to have to decide for itself, whether Rule 14 has the kind of flexibility that Giovannetti read into the federal rule. But I think that's an issue this court's going to have to decide. So if the court believes somehow that, yes, we have the discretion to do this, then I would say that the court should follow Giovannetti and not just simply say, well, we can do it anytime we want to, but rather follow Giovannetti and say there are very limited circumstances in which we can do it, and we're going to decide whether those circumstances exist before we even get to the merits of the issue. So that's kind of, Giovannetti is kind of a two-step process there.
Do we have any empirical knowledge about what happens in our court as opposed to the federal courts? In other words, has this problem, if you will, occurred in the past where this court hears an argument, finds that there was in fact error, and then says, well, it was harmless error, without the state having specifically made an argument that, well, if it's error, then we submit it's harmless? Well,
I guess my answer would be to look at the panel opinion in this case. If you read the panel opinion, you'd never know that the state didn't raise the argument. The court didn't say, we're looking at this sua sponte, and I suspect if you read any opinion where harmless error becomes an issue, reading the opinion will probably not give you a clue as to whether or not.
But you can go back and read the briefs.
Unless you go back and read the briefs, that's right.
So you're saying that we don't know whether the practice in this court has in fact been that the court reaches harmless error even if it's not specifically addressed?
Unless the court specifically says in an opinion, and I couldn't find any, we're going to consider this sua sponte even though nobody's raised it, I think you have to go back and look at the briefs.
If one side says there was error and another side says there is no error, why isn't harmless error subsumed in that analysis? Isn't it part of that spectrum?
Well, if you look at the federal cases on the issue of Giovannetti in those cases, that's what happened in those cases. The government's position was, we didn't think there was error. And the court disagreed, and the government tried to come back and say, oh, wait a minute. Well, if there is error, then it's harmless. And the court would say, uh-uh, you can't do that. So that's the way at least the federal courts handle that situation. Most of the time, at least in my experience, the state doesn't put all its eggs in one basket. They'll argue alternatively, well, we don't think it was error, but if you're not buying that, if you think it was, the error was harmless. And I've seen countless briefs filed by the state where that's the tack that is taken. Why it wasn't taken in this case, I don't know. But it wasn't. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the first prong of the panel's decision concluding it was harmless error because of the limiting instruction. And the limiting instruction is quoted in the panel opinion. I'm not going to read it. But basically, it tells the jury, you're going to see a video where there's a police interrogation and somebody making statements. Disregard whatever the police say. Don't pay any attention to it. It shouldn't come into play at all in your determination whether or not to believe what the witness, Zayas, is saying. Now, I guess one comment that I would have on that is, and this was a video that was almost an hour long, and there were constant back and forth and interruptions. In no sense was this video kind of a statement by Zayas. It was give and take from beginning to end. Zayas would say something, the police would either push him on it, disagree with him, prod him, whatever you want to call it. It was a real give and take here. And in my mind, at least, the suggestion is, if I'm on a jury, how can I possibly disregard that? What's going on? What I'm watching? In the context that it's presented. And if the court wanted the jury to disregard it, the simplest thing to do would be to redact what the police said. Because what the police said, number one, was vouching for this witness, and number two, what the police said is not relevant admissible evidence. It's not relevant admissible
but
evidence.
That's already been decided. You won on that one.
I know, but my point is that there was the limiting instruction was wrong. It was wrong to do that.
Well, in the best of all worlds, there would be no error in any trial, and there would be no error in this trial. But having determined that there was an error, the question then becomes, well, what was done about it? And in this case, the trial judge gave a limiting instruction.
Correct.
Now, I understand that it would have been better if there had been a redaction, and then you wouldn't need any limiting instruction. But what's wrong with... Well, this limiting instruction?
Here's what's wrong. And this is against the background of this court's precedent, which at least in my view holds that if there's an error and there's a limiting instruction, it's virtually impossible to get a reversal based on that error. This court has repeatedly held that limiting instructions pretty much act as a cure-all. And here's what's wrong with the limiting instruction in the context of this case. What's wrong with it is that, and my suggestion is that I will give the court credit for knowing what this court's rulings are on limiting instructions. And this is not the situation where the typical situation where limiting instruction happens, something happens in a trial that nobody expects to happen. A witness blurts out something that he shouldn't blurt out. And everybody's scrambling around trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And that's when limiting instructions come into play. This was something that was known in advance was going to happen. The judge made a conscious, deliberate decision. I'm going to let the jury watch this video, warts and all. And if I have a concern about the police, you know, the objection that the defense made, and I would suggest that the trial judge did have a concern, and that is what prompted the limiting instruction. And I would suggest using a limiting instruction in that way is wrong.
So what you're asking is for this court to kind of set a slightly new set of rules that says a limiting instruction can take care of or cure the prejudice of a mistake that happens inadvertently and without any advance notice, but that if an issue is raised and the court can see what's coming, then a limiting instruction will not qualify to cure the problem.
I believe that a limiting instruction should not be a device to let, and I believe that's what happened in this case. They had it both ways. They got their evidence in that should not have come in. And when the inevitable appeal follows, the state can say, look, no harm, no foul, there was a limiting instruction given. The defense didn't ask for a limiting instruction. This was something the court did. And my suggestion is that that is not a proper use of a limiting instruction. It's not a proper application of this court's precedent.
Well, I understand that, but I think if I interpret Justice Berger's point correctly, she's asking you, are we then to draft a new bright line rule? Because first blush, I would suggest to you that this is all about discretion in a trial judge, and it's all about the trial judge as trial manager. And there was some consideration for the extent to which doing more than giving a limited instruction would interrupt the ordinary course of the trial. Perhaps it would have to be continued for a day or two while it was redacted, and how that would affect the jury, and a number of other issues that we normally leave within the discretion of the trial judge. Why is that not adequate here?
I would suggest the trial judge had some serious doubts about the admissibility of the police statements. And all you have to do is look at this court's precedents, Holtzman, about police commenting on witnesses' testimony. And that's what, and it was obvious that's what was going on when you watched this video.
So I would concede that's true if there wouldn't have been a limiting instruction at all. But the point is, do we go with a new bright line rule? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well,
or do we leave it in the court's discretion, and then are we to determine whether this was an abuse of discretion?
I would suggest that using a limiting instruction under the circumstances of this case was an abuse of discretion. I don't know that the court has to go so far as to issue some sort of blanket rule that if you know something bad is going to happen and you can't use limiting instruction to ameliorate the bad thing that might happen. I think it's perfectly proper to use limiting instructions when you're trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. I have no quarrel with that, but that's not what happened here.
And are you saying no reasonable juror would have followed the limiting instruction?
I can't say that no, you know, in the universe of jurors, that there might be one or two people who might be alert enough or intelligent enough to do that, but I think it's just asking too much of your average juror. Because, and again, this is just anecdotal, reading a lot of books, people believe what they see in a video. There's studies and studies and studies that confirm that. And it's probably the most powerful evidence you can present to a jury. And then to give that to a jury and say, okay, you've just watched this video, now I want you to forget everything the police said, don't pay any attention to it, I would suggest that given the suggestive powers of video presentations, that would be very, very difficult to do.
The
last thing I'll talk about is the second.
Mr. Bernstein, before you get to that, I'm still struggling with how you would phrase the legal test under the approach you're suggesting. The Chief Justice asked whether the use of a limiting instruction should be reviewed under the abuse of discretion standard, and you said yes, it should. So, if I understand your position correctly, it is that it would be an abuse of discretion for a court to issue a limiting instruction when, but I need you to fill in the blank, and without metaphoric language, okay, such as putting the toothpaste back in the tube.
I think it's an abuse of discretion to use limiting instruction when the court is aware of a substantial possibility that what the court is about to do, either admit evidence, usually it's admit evidence, might be wrong, and essentially allow the state, as I said, to have it both ways.
When what the court is about to do may constitute error and the court is in a position to prevent the error.
I'm sorry?
I'm just rephrasing what you said. It would be an abuse of discretion to grant a curative instruction to cure an error that the court was in a position to prevent.
Well, yes, I would have to agree with that. And I think the facts of this case, and when you look at the facts of this case and this court's precedent, and I guess you have to impute some knowledge of those things to the trial judge, under the facts of this case, using a limiting instruction the way it was used was an abuse of discretion, in my opinion. I want to say a couple things about harmless error, the strength of the state's case. when I look for a kind of a summary of what the harmless error rule is, I think the best expression I found was this court's opinion in Capanna versus State, which is quoted at page 5 of the supplemental memo. And the last four lines are, ultimately, the court must weigh the significance of the error against the strength of the untainted evidence of guilt to determine whether the error may have affected the judgment. I think that's a fair statement of the harmless error rule. At least that's what the way this court expressed it in the Capanna decision. Now, when you look at Zayas' testimony, I would suggest that Zayas' testimony, and not just the video, but his in-court testimony as well, everything that came from Zayas was tainted by this police vouching. And if you take, and Zayas, what's significant about Zayas' testimony, he was the only one who presented evidence that could have convicted Hassan L. of felony murder. He was the one who talked, he was the only one who talked about the plan to rob, going up there was going to be a robbery, what happened. If you take Zayas out of the case, what you have left is a panic-driven, unbelievably tragic killing. There's no evidence of planned rob. There's no felony murder if there's no evidence of a plan to rob. All you have is a killing, and in Hassan L.'s case, the jury was given the option of convicting Hassan L. of intentional murder. He was found not guilty of intentional murder. He was found guilty of felony murder, however. So the jury ultimately, I would suggest, saw this case as a reckless killing. He was convicted of felony murder because Zayas provided the underlying felony. Now, without Zayas, there is no underlying felony. So I would suggest that if you apply the Capanna test to Mr. Zayas' testimony, you can't conclude, you have to conclude, I would suggest, that the untainted evidence was insufficient, certainly for the felony murder charge, and the tainted evidence did contribute to the jury's verdict, at least on the felony murder charge. I'm going to save the minute and 30 seconds I have left. Thank you.
Good afternoon. If it pleases the court, the state's position on direct appeal was, as it normally is, when an issue is raised below and the trial judge makes a decision, and that is the trial judge's decision was the correct one. Here the trial judge decided to let the evidence in that the defendant wanted cut out. The defendant wanted some of the tape redacted. The trial judge decided that the problem could be solved with a limiting instruction. So on appeal, that's the position that the state took. And I've been doing this for a long time, and that's normally the default position we take when the trial judge makes a decision. The trial judge has ruled with the wisdom of Solomon, and nobody can do any better. That's just our position. Now, if the court wants us to engage in harmless error analysis all the time, I don't know that's going to do a lot of good. But, this court came out with a decision while this case here was addressed on the defendant's motion for rehearing, and that's the Baker case, where this court goes in at great length as to harmless error, plain error, and how this court reviews these various issues. And it seems to me this court made very clear in Baker that harmless error and error analysis, a prejudice analysis, is built into the review. As this court said here at, I still have the Westlaw, but it's at Star 9, it is clear that where defense counsel fails to raise any objection at trial, and this is a prosecutorial misconduct case, and the trial judge fails to intervene sua sponte, we review claims of prosecutorial misconduct on appeal for plain error. Similarly, where defense counsel raises a pertinent, specific, and timely objection on prosecutorial misconduct, or the trial judge intervenes sua sponte, we will review for harmless error. And the court goes on, basically, to equate harmless error with plain error, and it's basically the same analysis. Now, in cases of prosecutorial conduct, there's a third step to the analysis, which is not pertinent here in this case, and that is the Hunter analysis, whether, despite the fact that the error complained of, the misconduct complained of, was in fact harmless beyond reasonable doubt or just harmless, we're nevertheless going to reverse because the misconduct is repetitive. We've seen it before, and we're just tired of seeing it, and we're going to put an end to it, we're going to reverse. But before, interestingly enough, as the way this court puts forward the analysis, the court only reaches the Hunter analysis, we're going to reverse anyhow, after the court has found, has done the harmless error analysis. And again, this is consistent with the rules of evidence, 103A. The defendant bears the burden of showing that an evidentiary ruling is prejudicial to substantial rights. As the court is perfectly aware, there's no such thing as a perfect trial. There is going to be error in the trial. The question isn't whether there is an error in the abstract. The question is whether the error complained of, whether the witness blurting something out the witness shouldn't have, whether somebody asks a question that shouldn't be asked, whether somebody says something in an argument that shouldn't be said. It's not whether that shouldn't have been done. There's lots of shouldn't have been done in the course of a trial. The question is whether it really made a difference. Did the defendant get a fair trial, which is always the paramount question, which means was the error so egregious as to constitute reversible error? That's just built into the analysis. Now, the state did not argue, and I concede, we never said the magic words harmless error or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I've never been able to figure out the difference between those two, but we never said harmless error or harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in the answering brief. But we did spend time talking about the efficacy of the trial judge's instruction to cure any possibility of prejudicial error. We were defending the trial judge's decision to go in this direction rather than redacting the tape recording. And as Mr. Bernstein pointed out, redacting the tape recording in this case was not simply snipping out one or two comments. It would have meant an entire reworking of the entire tape. And it would have been a process. I'm not sure why the defense didn't raise it ahead of trial, but still, it would have meant delaying the trial for a certain amount of time. And Mr. Bernstein also, in his argument, raised an interesting point: whether there should be
Mr. Donovan, this court, Mr. Donovan,
should be a bright line.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
This mic may not be working very well. One of the arguments that Mr. Bernstein has advanced is that the state didn't raise the harmless error argument. You appear to agree with that statement?
That the state never said,
okay,
this,
well,
harmless, this error, it was error, but it was harmless.
Okay, that being the case, it has that, you know, was it error for the court to address the issue of harmless error?
Oh, by no means. This court has discretion to do that or not. I mean, if the court wants to say we're not going to address it, you know, I'm firmly, you know,
Mr.
United States Courts of Appeal cases that the
Mr. Bernstein has made a reasoned argument based on mostly on federal authorities as to why the court is not free to take up that argument when it wasn't raised below. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, in the federal courts, and I think of the one, well, two cases, main cases that I would say to are both the first one, the Giovannetti case. Now, that case, it came on the state of the government's motion for re-argument, where the court made a decision saying that the error there was, the claim there was, in fact, erroneous and reverse. And then the court moved for re-argument in that case, saying, we'd like to argue that the error was harmless, and the court said, no, we're not going to do it. It's not the case here. I mean, here, this court has done the harmless error analysis. This is not the state's motion for re-argument. Speaking in metaphors, Mr. Bernstein said putting the toothpaste back in the tube or unringing the bell. I mean, that's basically what Mr. Bernstein is asking this court to do now, is say, well, we did do a harmless error analysis. We said the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but we're not going to do that now. We're going to decide, well, we're going to reverse it anyhow, which that doesn't make any sense to me. Now, if the court wants to make a rule henceforth, if the state does not argue harmless error on appeal, well, if the court says jump, we say how high. We will continue. We will from henceforth, append a harmless error analysis to every issue, I suppose. But it seems to me that the way this court has handled it in the past has been, as it has mentioned in Baker, and that an error analysis built into our analysis of whether there's error or not. And these evidentiary rulings particularly are not simply black and white. There's all kinds of shades of gray here. And it's very difficult to make bright-line rules. Here the judge is in a gray area, and this case was tried before the Miller case, which the court made rather clear, I think, that redaction should be the default. And now with Hassan L., I think it's crystal clear, if it wasn't before. Although I should point out that until Hassan L., the cases all concerned the rather special kind of prosecutor, that is child sexual abuse cases, where credibility is really the only issue. There is no, generally, any corroborating evidence. It's simply the child says, the defendant says, unlike this case. Now, this is the first case, I think, to address this issue of a police officer or some other kind of professional, like in Wheaton Powell, they were some kind of psychologist or something, expressing opinions regarding the truth or falsity of a witness's statements or what the defendant is saying. That was the case of Holtzman or Miller. No, Holtzman. This is the first time this court has made it clear that redaction should be the default in all cases, and my assumption is that from now on it will be, rather than relying on a cautionary instruction. But again, this is a gray area. The trial judge, as the court has noted, in his trial judge's responsibility for managing the trial, has difficult gray area type of decisions to make throughout the trial. And the court here decided one that this court on appeal decided, well, we think that the court should have redacted, but our analysis as to prejudice indicates that The court's abuse of discretion was not, in fact, does not amount to a reversible error.
Could you focus on that for a moment, please? Mr. Bernstein argued that the tape itself shouldn't have come in the form it came in, which was our holding, but that moreover, because that tape did come in with all the police comments, that it tainted not only that tape itself, but also Zayas' in-court testimony, and that if you looked at the trial without his testimony at all, it would be a very close case, or maybe even there'd be no case against his client for felony murder, which would get to the issue of prejudice. What's the state's response to that?
Well, if, now this court, again, this court's ruling on appeal was that the police officers' comments in the tape that were heard by the jury may have, in fact, produced a taint. Otherwise, you know, why say it was erroneous? And that any possible taint was not completely cured, was not sufficiently cured by the instruction of the trial judge. Now, there's a difference between, you know, a possible taint and that is the evidence itself is no good. Now, there was no indication here that the Zayas' testimony was anything other than what it was, whether his testimony is in-court testimony or what he said eventually piecemeal during the police interrogation. So that was still good evidence. And the interesting thing about Zayas' testimony was that, and what he finally said in his statement, was that it dovetailed very nicely with the other evidence of the case, the evidence that came from Flowers, the evidence that came from Archie, who knew a great deal about this, and even to the fact of finding the cold can of cherry soda on the floor of the ice cream truck, which Zayas said, you know, I was going to exchange my frozen can of cherry soda. That's why I flagged the ice cream truck down, and they find cold can of cherry soda there on the ice cream truck. So there was plenty of evidence to support Zayas' testimony and what he told the police in the statement. It's simply not Zayas' testimony standing alone, as unfortunately is often the case in these child sexual abuse cases, where it's the statement of the child standing alone versus the statement of the accused standing alone. In this case, there is plenty of, like I say, corroborating evidence, and actually an unusual amount for a case like this, where the evidence actually does seem to dovetail together, and you don't have witnesses going in different directions. Everybody seems to be on the same page here. So if there was a taint, and if I read this court's opinion correctly, whatever the taint was, it was not so great. In light of all the evidence, corroborating evidence, the trial judge's instructions particularly, that the evidence was still good, in other words. It could still be considered by the jury, and therefore the conviction should not be reversed. So that's how I would answer that, and I hope it answers the court's question. Just because there's a taint doesn't mean the evidence is totally no good. And here, again, especially in light of the trial judge's instruction, which really went to the heart of the problem. Again, on appeal, this court said the better course would have been to gone through with the redaction and just take the police officers' various statements out entirely, since they're not really is admissible under 3507. It's the defendant's statement, not what the police officers are saying. If the court has no further questions,
thank you, Mr. Donovan.
Look, I jotted down a few notes that I wanted to comment on a couple of things that Mr. Donovan said. The first thing that I want to take issue with is Mr. Donovan seemed to express the view that because the court granted the appellant's motion for rehearing in bank, that that made consideration of the harmless error on the merits fully in play. And I would disagree with that. I would disagree with that because the principal reason the motion for a hearing in bank was filed was because the court considered this issue sua sponte without giving anyone, especially the appellant, an opportunity to put their two cents in. And obviously, if we've had that opportunity, there was one case, and I don't remember the name of it, that was cited in the motion for a hearing where the court was considering doing harmless error analysis sua sponte, but before they did it, informed the parties, this is on the table. We want your input on whether, number one, whether or not we can do it, and number two, if we can, what the outcome should be. That didn't happen, unfortunately, in this case, and that's what prompted, to a large extent, the motion for a hearing. So I would suggest the court's power to, or discretion to hear the harmless error issue on the merits is very much in play in this case. And unless the court has any questions about that, that's all I'm going to say about that. The second point, I only have a second, well, I won't bring up the second point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.